It's really amazing when you stop and think about how much goes into managing our health these days.
Oh, yeah.
There's just so much to keep track of.
Absolutely.
It's a lot, especially when you're dealing with something like hemophilia, where you've got multiple specialists involved. I mean, trying to keep all those different pieces of information and appointments straight, it can be a real challenge sometimes.
It can be really tough, yeah. For folks like you, our listener, who are living with hemophilia, that kind of complexity is probably something that you know all too well.
Right.
And so that's what we're going to dive into today. We're going to take a really deep dive into some fascinating research coming out of the Netherlands that's all about how we can make healthcare better for people with hemophilia.
Exactly. And you were kind enough to share a really comprehensive PhD thesis with us that goes into all these different aspects of hemophilia care. And it even explores the potential role of digital tools, which is really interesting. But before we go any further, just to make sure everyone's on the same page, let's quickly touch on what hemophilia is, just in case anyone's not super familiar.
Okay, sounds good.
So hemophilia is a condition that people are born with where their blood doesn't clot properly because they're missing certain clotting factors. You can kind of think of these factors like the glue that helps your blood solidify when you get a cut.
Right.
And so without enough of this glue, even minor injuries can become pretty serious because the bleeding might not stop as quickly as it should.
Yeah.
So people with hemophilia often need regular preventative treatment to help their blood clot better.
Right.
And in the Netherlands, most of this specialized care is provided at six dedicated hemophilia centers.
Yeah, that centralization, bringing all that expertise together, it's really beneficial for patients. But I think it also brings up a really crucial question for you, our listener.
Okay.
How do you navigate all the different aspects of your care when you have such complex healthcare needs, especially when you might be seeing doctors both within these specialized centers and in other healthcare settings as well?
Right.
How do you keep track of all your information? How do you make sure everyone's on the same page? And how do you feel empowered to really take ownership of your own healthcare journey?
That's a big one.
It is. It
But
is.
that's really what we're going to be focusing on today.
Absolutely.
Our mission for this deep dive is to pull out the key insights from all this research, and we're going to be looking at everything from how satisfied patients are with their current care to that big transition from pediatric to adult services. And then we're going to get into the whole world of personal health records and even see how digital diaries can be used to track treatment and what that data tells us.
Sounds like a plan.
All right, so let's jump in and start with how patients are feeling about the care they're receiving right now. The research suggests that there's actually a pretty high level of satisfaction with hemophilia care in the Netherlands overall.
Yeah, to get a sense of just how satisfied people are, they used a specific measurement tool called the HemoSat, which gives a numerical score, and a lower score actually means higher satisfaction.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and in this case, the median HemoSat score was 12.
Okay.
Which means that on average, patients in the Netherlands seem to be pretty happy with their hemophilia care.
That's good to hear.
It is, but it's also important to note that the scores did range from 6 all the way up to 21.
Okay.
So there is definitely a range of experiences, and that suggests that there are some folks who are maybe not as satisfied as others.
Right. So it's not a perfect picture for everyone.
Exactly. And that's why it's important to really dig into what's driving those differences in satisfaction. What's making some people happier than others, so we can figure out where improvements can be made.
So, what are some of the key factors that seem to be linked to this high level of satisfaction that they found?
Well, the research highlighted a few things, like how patients feel about their interactions with their healthcare providers, feeling like those interactions are positive and respectful, having good communication, that's really important.
Yeah, that makes sense. Feeling heard and understood by your doctor can make a huge difference.
It really can. Another factor was whether care felt readily available when people needed it. Feeling like you can easily get an appointment or reach your healthcare team when you have a concern, that definitely contributes to satisfaction.
Right. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of how well coordinated the care is.
Absolutely. Making sure that all the different parts of your care are working together smoothly.
Right. So that you're not feeling like you're falling through the cracks or that you're having to repeat the same information over and over again to different doctors,
Right.
because that can be so frustrating.
It can be really, really frustrating. And these themes, actually, they make sense when you think about what makes for good healthcare in general, regardless of what specific condition you're dealing with. Clear communication, easy access, and that coordinated approach, those are consistently crucial for people's well-being and their experiences with healthcare systems overall.
But even though the overall picture seems pretty positive, the research did identify some areas where there's room for improvement, right?
Oh, absolutely.
What were some of the things that came up?
Well, one of the big ones was how information is provided to patients.
Okay.
Making sure people have access to the information they need in a way that they can understand it and use it to make informed decisions.
Yeah. So not just getting a bunch of technical jargon thrown at you, but having things explained in a way that's clear and helpful.
Exactly. And then closely tied to that is the whole issue of care coordination.
Right.
Especially when we're talking about care that involve providers outside of those specialized hemophilia centers. Because as we were saying earlier, patients often have to see their regular family doctor, go to local hospitals, consult other specialists for various reasons. Mm-hmm. So making sure that information flows smoothly between all those different parts of the system is really key.
It's like those different parts need to be able to talk to each other.
Exactly, exactly. And the thesis actually pointed to the possibility of digital health tools being used to help address these challenges.
Okay, so how could those tools potentially help with things like information sharing and care coordination?
Well, imagine if you had a way to securely access all your important health information from all your different providers in one place.
Mm-hmm.
Your medical history, your test results, medications you're taking, everything.
Okay, that would be helpful.
It would. And then imagine if this information could be easily shared with all the different doctors who are involved in your care.
Okay.
That way, everyone would be working from the same page. You wouldn't have to be the one trying to remember everything and relay it back and forth.
Right. That makes sense. And I think the thesis actually highlights some really specific issues that people brought up about their experiences, right?
Yeah, definitely. For instance, a lot of the adult patients who participated, it was around 79 of them, they mentioned that they felt like the cost of healthcare was just too high.
Okay, so that's a big concern for a lot of people.
It is. Yeah. And then there were some really powerful quotes from patients who had filled out questionnaires as part of the research. One person said, and I'm quoting here from question 5, I would like better teamwork between hospitals and the GP.
Okay, so that goes back to that whole coordination issue we were just talking about.
Exactly. They're really emphasizing that need for different parts of the healthcare system to work together more effectively.
Right. And there was another quote from question 6 where someone said, it would be good if there was more consultation between providers from different institutions.
Yes, yes. Again, highlighting that desire for better communication and collaboration.
I feel like those quotes really make those concerns so much more real.
They do. They give a voice to the numbers, don't they? They really bring those experiences to life.
And it wasn't all positive, right? There were some concerning reports about experiences in emergency departments.
Yes, unfortunately, some people shared some pretty negative experiences about going to emergency departments where the staff didn't seem to have specific expertise in dealing with hemophilia.
Oh, wow. That's worrying.
It is, yeah. And that was mentioned in question 7.
I mean, I can only imagine how stressful that must be.
Absolutely.
If you're having a bleeding episode and people who are supposed to be helping you aren't really sure how to manage it properly.
Exactly. It highlights the importance of making sure that all healthcare professionals have at least some basic understanding of how to handle hemophilia emergencies.
Right, because even though the specialized centers are clearly providing excellent care, you can't always guarantee that you're going to be able to get there in an emergency.
That's right.
So there needs to be a safety net in place.
Absolutely. And while we're talking about the specialized centers, the research also highlighted some really positive things that are happening within those centers.
Oh, good. What were some of the things that stood out?
Well, patients really appreciated the excellent collaboration between the healthcare professionals within those centers.
Okay, so that teamwork that we were talking about earlier seems to be working really well within the specialized centers.
It seems to be, yeah. And then the concentration of expertise, you know, having all those different specialists in one place, that was another big plus.
Right, so you've got doctors, nurses, physiotherapists, social workers, all those different disciplines working together.
Exactly. And that allows them to take a much more holistic approach to each patient's care, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And then the role of the specialized hemophilia nurses was also specifically mentioned as being really valuable.
Oh, okay. What do they do that's so helpful?
Well, they often become a key point of contact for the patient. They help to coordinate all the different aspects of their care, answer questions, provide support and education, and just really advocate for the patient's needs.
So they're kind of like a central hub for the patient to connect with.
Exactly.
That's great.
It is, yeah. And all those positive aspects, the teamwork, the expertise, the nursing support, Those were all highlighted in question 15.
Okay, so we've talked about patient satisfaction, and we've touched on some of the good and bad experiences that people have had. But the research also delved into how people feel about using digital tools to manage their hemophilia, right?
Yes, it did.
What did they find there?
Well, it seems like patients were generally pretty open to the idea of using these tools and felt that they could offer some real benefits.
Okay, like what?
Well, one thing that came up, and this was mentioned in question 21, was that patients felt like digital tools could help them understand their hemophilia better overall.
Okay, so it could be a way for them to learn more about their condition and how to manage it.
Exactly. They could track their symptoms, see how their treatment is affecting them, maybe access educational resources.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that came up, and this is from question 22, is that they felt like these tools could actually improve the conversations they have with their healthcare team during their checkups.
Interesting.
Yeah. You know, if they're tracking their symptoms and their treatments in a digital diary, they can easily share that information with their doctor, and it could lead to more focused and productive discussions.
Right. So instead of relying on memory, they've got all that data right there at their fingertips.
Exactly.
But I imagine there are also concerns about relying too much on digital tools, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, what if someone's not comfortable with technology?
Yeah, that's a really important point.
Or what if they don't have reliable internet access?
Yeah, that whole issue of the digital divide was definitely raised as a concern by both patients and healthcare professionals.
Right, because we don't want to create a situation where some people are benefiting from these new technologies while others are being left behind.
Exactly.
So it's really important to make sure that any digital health tools that are developed are accessible to everyone.
Absolutely. And that means not just making sure the technology is available, but also making sure it's user-friendly.
Nope.
And that people have the support they need to learn how to use it effectively.
Right. So we need to be really mindful of those potential barriers and make sure that we're not inadvertently excluding anyone.
Exactly. And it's probably also a good idea to make sure that there are non-digital alternatives available for people who aren't comfortable with technology or who don't have access to it.
Yeah, so that everyone has a choice in how they manage their care.
Exactly.
So now let's shift gears a little bit and talk about another really important aspect of hemophilia care, the transition from pediatric to adult services.
Okay, yeah.
This is something that all young people with hemophilia have to go through, and it can be a pretty daunting experience.
It can be. It's a time of huge change in their lives, and they're not only navigating all the usual challenges of adolescence and young adulthood, but they're also having to take on more responsibility for managing their condition.
Right. So they're transitioning from being primarily under the care of their parents to being more independent in their healthcare decision making.
Exactly. And often that also involves changing healthcare teams, you know, moving from a pediatric hemophilia center to an adult one, which can be quite a big adjustment.
And the research actually focused specifically on this transition period, right?
It did. They looked at adolescents between the ages of 12 and 17 and young adults between 18 and 25.
Okay.
And what they found was that within the adolescent group, the older they got, the more prepared they felt for this transition.
That makes sense, Ray. The closer you are to actually making that switch, the more you start thinking about it and preparing for it.
Exactly. And then when they looked at the young adults who had already made the transition, almost all of them reported feeling ready for it when it happened.
Oh, that's encouraging.
It is. It suggests that the transition programs in the Netherlands are generally doing a pretty good job of preparing young people for this change.
That's great to hear.
And interestingly, there was also a link between this feeling of readiness and how well people were adhering to their treatment.
Oh, okay. So the people who felt more prepared were also more likely to be sticking to their treatment plan.
Exactly. And they measured treatment adherence using something called Veritas Pro Scores.
Okay.
So this finding really emphasizes how important it is to properly prepare young people for this transition.
Right, because if they feel confident and knowledgeable about how to manage their condition on their own, they're more likely to stay on track with their treatment.
Exactly. But of course, no system is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
The research did identify some specific areas where the transition process could be improved.
Okay, what were some of those areas?
Well, one thing that came up was that young adults felt like they could have had more opportunities to get to know the adult treatment team before the actual transition happened.
Okay, so it wasn't so much of a sudden shift, but more of a gradual introduction to the new doctors and nurses they would be working with.
Exactly. And then another area that was highlighted was the need for more information and guidance about managing healthcare costs.
Right, because that's a whole new level of responsibility that young adults are taking on.
It is.
And it can be pretty overwhelming if you're not prepared for it.
It can be. So those were two key areas where young people felt like they could have been better supported during the transition.
And what about the content of the preparation itself? Were there any topics that were being covered more or less than others?
Yes, actually. The researchers looked at which topics were most frequently discussed as part of the transition preparation.
Okay.
And they found that things like general life issues, worries specifically related to hemophilia, and just overall knowledge about hemophilia were high on the list.
Okay, so those are all important areas to cover for sure. But were there any topics that were maybe being overlooked?
Yes. Interestingly, there were a couple of topics that were discussed less frequently.
Okay, what were those?
One was actually getting to know the specific healthcare providers in the adult care setting.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And then the other one was getting guidance on how to navigate issues related to work or school.
Right, because those are such huge parts of a young adult's life, and hemophilia can definitely have an impact on them.
Exactly.
So it seems like there's an opportunity to beef up those areas of the transition preparation.
Absolutely. By having more of those specific conversations, healthcare teams could really help young people integrate their hemophilia care into their broader life goals and help them anticipate and overcome any potential challenges that might come up in those areas.
Okay, so we've covered patient satisfaction, the transition to adult care, and now let's dive into personal health records, or PHRs.
Okay, yeah.
The research really explores both the potential benefits of these tools and also some of the challenges that come with them, right?
Yes, it does.
So before we get into all that, can you just give us a quick rundown of what PHRs actually are and why they're becoming such a big deal in healthcare?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, as we've been talking about, healthcare can be pretty fragmented. People see multiple providers, they go to different hospitals, they have information scattered all over the place. And right now, most hospitals and healthcare systems have their own electronic health record systems like HeHex and Epic, which were specifically mentioned in the thesis as examples of systems used in the Netherlands.
Okay.
But the problem is that these systems often don't talk to each other very well.
Oh, okay. So even though everything's electronic, the information might not be easily shared between different providers.
Exactly.
So for someone like you, our listener, who's trying to manage your hemophilia care across different hospitals and specialists, it can be really hard to get a complete picture of your health history in one place. And that's where PHRs come in. The idea behind a PHR is to give you, the patient, a central place to access, manage, and even share all your health data from all those different providers.
Exactly.
So it's like having your own personal health hub.
It is. It is. And the hope is that this will lead to all sorts of benefits.
Okay, like what?
Well, first of all, it could mean greater transparency for you as a patient.
Okay, so you have more visibility into your own health information.
Exactly. Yeah. And that could lead to a better understanding of your condition, how it's being managed, what the different treatment options are, things like that.
Okay, that makes sense.
It could also lead to improved coordination of care. If all your providers can see the same information, it reduces the risk of things getting missed or miscommunicated.
Right, right.
And then it could make shared decision-making easier. You know, if you and your doctor are both looking at the same information, it can facilitate more informed and collaborative discussions about your care.
So it's really about putting the patient at the center of their healthcare journey, giving them more control, more knowledge, more agency.
Exactly, exactly.
But as you mentioned, there are also some concerns that have been raised about PHRs.
Oh, absolutely. It's not all sunshine and rainbows.
Right. What are some of the things that people are worried about?
Well, usability is a big one.
Okay.
You know, if these systems aren't user-friendly, if they're difficult to navigate or understand, then people aren't going to use them.
Right.
And then, of course, there are big concerns about safety.
Okay, so making sure that people's health information is kept private and secure.
Exactly. And this was specifically mentioned in question 30.
But,
people are understandably worried about who has access to their data and how it's being protected. And then closely tied to that is the issue of inclusivity.
Right, that digital divide that we talked about earlier.
Exactly.
Making sure that these systems don't inadvertently exclude people who aren't comfortable with technology or who don't have reliable access to it.
Right, and that came up in question 32. Okay. So those are some of the key concerns that have been raised about PHRs.
Were there any other worries that came up in the research?
Yes, there were a couple more that are worth mentioning. One was the potential for patients to misinterpret medical information if they don't have the right context.
Okay, yeah, I can see how that could be a problem. You know, just seeing a lab result without any explanation could be really confusing or even scary.
Exactly. And this is highlighted in question 33. So it's really important to think about how information is presented in a PHR and to make sure that people have access to clear explanations and support if they need it.
Right. So it can't just be about dumping data on people. It has to be about presenting it in a way that's meaningful and helpful.
Absolutely. And then the other concern that was raised is just the practical challenge of actually implementing these systems effectively.
Okay, so getting all the different pieces to work together smoothly.
Exactly. You know, it's one thing to have the technology, but it's another thing entirely to get all the different stakeholders on board, to make sure the data is flowing correctly, mm-hmm. to deal with all the technical and logistical issues that inevitably arise.
Right. So there's a lot of work involved in getting these systems up and running and making sure they're working as intended.
Absolutely.
So it sounds like PHRs have a lot of potential, but there are also some significant hurdles to overcome before they can truly live up to that potential.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
The research also looked at what features people would ideally like to see in a PHR, right?
It did, yeah.
What were some of the things that came up?
Well, being able to access their medical history was a big one.
Okay, so that would include things like past diagnoses, surgeries, treatments, that kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah. And then people also wanted access to their test results, you know, things like blood work, imaging scans, any kind of diagnostic tests they've had.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they wanted to be able to see a list of all the medications they're currently taking.
Okay.
And that specific desire was mentioned in question 11.
Okay, that all makes sense.
Oh.
What else was on the wish list?
Well, people also wanted summaries of their care, you know, kind of like a condensed version of their medical history that highlighted the key points.
Okay.
And then they wanted information about their allergies, notes from their consultations with different providers, any correspondence between doctors, things like that.
So it's really about having all that information in one place and being able to see the big picture.
Exactly. Exactly. And people also wanted tools to help them manage their appointments.
Okay. So being able to schedule appointments, get reminders, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And then the ability for caregivers to access relevant information was also seen as really important.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. You know, for people who rely on support from family members or other carers in managing their health, being able to share access to their PHR could be really helpful.
Right. It could make it easier for those caregivers to stay informed and involved in their loved one's care.
Absolutely.
So it sounds like there's a lot of demand for these kinds of comprehensive personal health record systems.
There definitely is.
But what's the actual state of PHRs in the Netherlands right now?
Well, the thesis gave us a little snapshot of where things stood around early 2023 and 2024.
Okay.
And at that time, it seemed like most general practitioners and hospitals had the technical capability to share data with PHRs.
Okay, so the infrastructure was there.
It was.
Yeah.
But the actual use of these systems by patients was still pretty low.
Oh, okay. So people weren't really taking advantage of them yet. Why was that?
Well, there were a couple of main reasons. One was that a lot of people just weren't familiar with PHRs. They didn't really know what they were or how they could benefit from them.
Right. So there was a lack of awareness.
Exactly. And then the other reason was that there just wasn't that much information available in the PHRs at that time.
Okay.
So even if you were interested in using a PHR, you might not find all the information you were looking for in there.
So it was kind of like a chicken and egg situation. People weren't using them because there wasn't much information, but there wasn't much information because people weren't using them.
Exactly.
It sounds like the government has played a pretty active role in trying to promote PHRs, right?
They have, yeah.
What have they been doing?
Well, initially, they provided some funding to support the development of PHRs.
Okay.
But then they actually discontinued that funding.
Oh, okay. Why was that?
Well, it's not entirely clear from the thesis, but it seems like there might have been some disagreements or changes in strategy.
Okay.
But later on, they did launch a tender process to select three specific PHR systems that they would support further.
Oh, okay. So they kind of narrowed it down to a few key players.
Exactly. And then there's also been discussion about the potential for a government-run PHR platform called My Health Overview.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it seems like there's still a lot of discussion and debate about the best way to approach this whole PHR thing.
Right. And what role the government should play in it.
Exactly.
But what's the takeaway message here for our listener who's trying to make sense of all this?
Well, I think the key takeaway is that PHRs have the potential to be really valuable tools for managing your health information and taking a more active role in your care. But they're still in the early stages of development, and there's some significant challenges that need to be addressed.
Right, like making sure they're user-friendly, secure, accessible to everyone.
Exactly. And then also figuring out how to integrate all the different data sources effectively.
Right, because if the information isn't standardized and easily shared between different systems, then it defeats the whole purpose of having a PHR in the first place.
Exactly.
So it's a complex landscape, but it's definitely an area to keep an eye on because it's likely to have a big impact on how healthcare is delivered in the future.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we've talked about PHRs, and now let's move on to another type of digital tool that's being used in hemophilia care. Digital treatment diaries.
Okay, yeah.
Can you explain what those are and how they're being used?
Sure. So digital treatment diaries are basically electronic tools that allow people with hemophilia to log their bleeds and their infusions of medication.
Okay.
And this data can be really valuable for a couple of reasons.
Okay, what are they?
Well, first of all, it can help individuals keep track of their own condition and see how well their treatment is working.
Right, so it's like a self-monitoring tool.
Exactly. And then the other reason is that this data can be aggregated and used for broader clinical research.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah. It can give researchers real-world insights into how different treatments are performing in everyday practice.
Right. So it's like a complement to the data that's collected in clinical trials.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And Thesis actually highlighted a specific study that used data from these nationwide digital treatment diaries to assess how people with severe hemophilia A were doing on a newer treatment called emicizumab.
Oh, okay. What did they find?
Well, they looked at things like the average number of bleeds per year, the average number of joint bleeds per year, and they also looked at what proportion of people on emicizumab were able to achieve zero treated bleeds and zero treated joint bleeds over different periods of time.
So it was really about understanding how well this new treatment was working in the real world.
Exactly. And that kind of data is really important because it can help inform treatment decisions and give us a better understanding of the long-term effectiveness of different therapies.
Right, because clinical trials are great for establishing initial efficacy and safety, but they don't always capture the full picture of how a treatment will perform once it's out in the wild, so to speak.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, it's not always possible to enroll every type of patient in a clinical trial.
Right.
So having this real-world data from these digital diaries can help fill in those gaps and give us a more complete picture.
But it sounds like the study also uncovered a potential issue with the data coming from these diaries, right?
Yes, it did.
What was that?
Well, they found that a significant percentage of bleeds that were documented in the official electronic health records, around 33%, were not actually reported by patients in their digital diaries.
Oh, wow. That's a pretty big discrepancy.
It is. And it suggests that there might be some underreporting going on.
Okay, so why might that be happening?
Well, there could be a few reasons. Maybe people forget to log all their bleeds, or maybe they don't consider certain bleeds to be significant enough to report, or maybe there's some confusion about what exactly constitutes a bleed that needs to be logged.
Right. And I imagine if someone's having a bleed that's serious enough to require hospitalization, they might not even think about logging it in their diary at that time.
Exactly. They're probably more focused on just getting the medical care they need.
Right.
So it's important to figure out why this underreporting is happening and how significant it is, because it could have implications for how we interpret the data from these diaries and how we understand the true effectiveness of different treatments.
Right, because if we're only capturing a portion of the bleeds that are actually happening, then our data might be skewed.
Exactly.
So what can be done to improve this?
Well, the researchers made a couple of recommendations. One was to establish